stake in its old left politics or in orthodox Marxism. As Greece's debts were no longer market loans, but debts owed to the Troika, his tactic was to mobilize the pragmatism of the market against the financial orthodoxy of the Eurozone. He courted the support of the City of London, the Financial Times, and authorities like Larry Summers, as well as a coterie of American economic advisers that included both confirmed leftists, such as Jamie K. Galbraith, and Jeffrey Sachs, one-time exponent of shock therapy for the post-communist world. Varoufakis argued that the ideologues on the Greek debt question were not those who insisted that unpayable debts were unpayable. The ideologues were the conservative disciplinarians in the Eurogroup who insisted that debts must be paid as a matter of principle, regardless of the cost. The system that Varoufakis attacked was not capitalism, but Europe's moribund and dysfunctional austerity fixation and its collaborators in Greece and beyond. Juxtaposing rational economics against conservative ideology was an effective political argument on Varoufakis's part. It would win him a considerable international following. But it underestimated his opponents. The project of fiscal consolidation imposed on Europe under German leadership was certainly political. But it was not only that. It was a vision of a long-term reordering of Europe's society and economy. Merkel was fond of shocking unsuspecting visitors with the remark that unless Europe reformed, it would go the way of Inca civilization. In pursuit of its goal, to be realized over the course of a decade, Berlin did not flinch from imposing heavy short-term costs. That is what reform of a failing social and economic model entailed. That was the lesson of the collapse of communism, the economic project of German unification, and the incorporation of Eastern Europe into the EU. In pursuing that project, one could make concessions neither to the short-term time horizons of markets nor to Syriza-style protest politics. To ensure that Europe stayed the course, it was essential to contain political contagion. It would be disastrous to make concessions to the far-left government in Greece, concessions that during the crisis had been denied to the governments of Eastern Europe, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal. Whatever the misery of the Greek population, it hardly mattered in the wider economic balance of the Eurozone. The battle was about the wider questions of political discipline and authority, which, as the conservative globalists in Berlin saw it, were the foundations for long-term economic success. The fight was all the more bitter because the austerity hawks in the Eurogroup knew that the centrist governments of France and Italy were susceptible. In 2012, Hollande's government in France had wanted to push a more expansive policy. The growth agenda, which had been so crucial to the political manoeuvring following Hollande's election, had made precious little headway. Now the new government in Rome, headed by the popular centrist Matteo Renzi, was tempted in a similar direction. That made it all the more important to hold the line against Syriza. Germany was the anchor, but in the most crucial negotiations, Finance Minister Schäuble barely needed to speak. The Dutchman, Jeroen Dijsselbloem, chaired the Eurogroup session, and the argument against Syriza would be carried by Austrian stalwarts like Spain's Luis de Guindos and Portugal's Maria Luís Albuquerque. They knew that in stopping Syriza, they were fighting for their own political lives and the project they had dedicated their countries to when they signed up to the austerity agenda in 2011. The irony was that in expressing their preference for the established parties in Greece, the Eurogroup and the IMF were aligning themselves precisely with those political forces and social interests that had created Greece's deplorable fiscal situation. Nor were these entanglements limited to politics. At the heart of the business oligarchy and its media network were Greek banks. They had been recapitalized in 2012 as part of the restructuring deal at the expense of the Greek taxpayer, but they continued to depend heavily on funding from the Greek Central Bank and the ECB. Since June 2014, the Greek Central Bank had been headed by Yanis Stournaras, another of Greece's persuasive economics professors, one of the architects of Greece's admission to the original Eurozone and finance minister in the outgoing Samaras government. When it became clear in December 2014 that Syriza was ahead in the polls and that it might soon come to power, Stornaros did nothing to staunch a slow-bleeding bank run. Ahead of the election, better-off Greeks had already withdrawn 16 billion euros from the banks. When Tsipras took office, a further 8 billion euros were pulled out in a matter of only 3 weeks. The effect of this capital flight was to push the banks ever deeper into dependence on the ECB. If the Syriza government refused to cooperate with the Troika, the ECB, as it had done in Ireland and Greece before, could threaten to curtail emergency lending to the banks. It would be a devastating blow. But did the Troika really want to risk a renewed crisis in the Eurozone? This threat of financial contagion was the major bargaining counter of the Greek government. If Brussels, Frankfurt and Berlin pushed Greece over the edge, it might take others with it. But in this regard, 3 days before Syriza took office, the game was decisively changed. On January 22, 2015, Mario Draghi announced that the ECB was finally adopting full-scale QE. 2.5 years after Draghi's whatever it takes, it was not a move that the ECB undertook with any enthusiasm. Between 2012 and 2014, Draghi had allowed the balance sheet of the ECB to contract. What forced his hand in 2015 was the acute threat of deflation. To counter slumping prices, Draghi had tried every alternative. A new installment of the long-term refinancing operations this time found no takers. The European banks were intent on deleveraging. It was not until September 2014 that Draghi commenced QE Lite by buying private asset-backed securities. Predictably, there was immediate indignation in Germany. The trigger for bolder action was a preliminary opinion issued on January 14, 2015, by the European Court of Justice, which decided, in a case referred to it by the German Supreme Court, that Draghi's bond-buying scheme of 2012 had not constituted a prima facie breach of the ban on monetary financing. Without waiting for a final ruling, the ECB acted. On January 22, 2015, Draghi announced that until Eurozone inflation stabilized safely in the positive range, the ECB would buy sovereign bonds at the rate of 60 billion euros per month. In the coincidence of the ECB's turn to monetary activism with Syriza's election victory in January 2015, the economic and political consequences of the Eurozone crisis finally caught up with each other. The conjuncture would have fateful consequences. Ironically, it was the ECB's bond-buying program, long opposed by Europe's conservatives, that freed them to fight the battle for political containment by any means necessary. With the ECB in the market, there was no risk that the Greek drama would spill over into financial contagion. As the ECB's purchases kicked in and drained sovereign bonds from the markets, yields on Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian debt fell. In 2010, the IMF had advocated precisely this course so as to allow the Irish banking crisis to be resolved in an equitable fashion, through PSI and not entirely at the expense of taxpayers. Then Trichet had blocked the way. Now Draghi's deployment of QE enabled the conservative majority of the Eurogroup to lay siege to Greece's left-wing government without fear of precipitating a general crisis. Did this mean that the outcome was foreordained? Did Syriza even comprehend the depth of the predicament it was in? From contemporary sources and publicly available information, it was unclear. But Varoufakis's memoirs reveal that at least some within Tsipras's cabinet understood the scale of the challenge. As an economic theorist, Varoufakis's specialty was game theory. He knew that Draghi's turn to QE boxed Athens in. If the Syriza government wanted to gain purchase on the debt negotiations, it needed a threat of its own that would restore the risk of financial contagion. Varoufakis believed that a wrinkle in the bailout agreement of 2012, combined with a mounting wave of nationalist resentment in Germany, gave Greece the leverage it needed. On the books of the ECB were 30 billion euros in bonds purchased under Trichet's SMP program. These were left untouched by the 2012 restructuring, and they were under Greek law. If Greece unilaterally defaulted on those bonds, it would inflict severe losses on the ECB, highlighting the dangers involved in bond buying and more or less forcing the German right wing to reopen the question of the legality of QE. With QE's legal foundation in question, confidence would crumble. The firewall would be down. The entire Eurozone periphery would be in peril once more, and the Eurogroup would have to take Greece's demands seriously for fear of panic spreading through the markets. Given Greece's weakness, it is melodramatic to describe this as the nuclear option. But what Varoufakis was preparing was certainly a dirty bomb. To force the Eurogroup to negotiate in earnest, Greece would threaten to unhinge the fragile political balance on which Draghi's stabilization of the entire Eurozone depended. It would deliberately unleash civil war in the Eurozone. Due to legal technicalities, it was in fact unclear whether a Greek default would hit the ECB directly or simply Greece's own central bank. But the threat certainly caused alarm in Frankfurt and Brussels. Varoufakis had the legal order for a default drafted and kept on hand in his ministry. The question was whether the Tsipras government would have the nerve to deploy its deterrent at the crucial moment. The first round of meetings between Greece's new government and its creditors in Brussels went so badly that they came close to precipitating an immediate rupture. Merkel, her foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and their French counterparts jetted into Brussels on February 12, 2015, for a European Council meeting fresh from grueling negotiations with Putin over the Minsk II ceasefire in Donbass. Ukraine, not Greece, was top of the agenda, and the new Greek foreign minister did not endear himself to his colleagues by threatening to veto further sanctions against Putin. In his first Eurogroup meeting on February 11th, Varoufakis struck a more conciliatory tone, insisting on Syriza's European credentials and its commitment to work in good faith. He insisted that they were not populists promising all things to all people. But Schäuble's response was blunt. Syriza had not been part of the 2012 deal with the Greek political parties, but Varoufakis needed to understand, as far as the fundamentals of the Eurozone were concerned, that elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. It was an astonishing statement on its face, but one that encapsulated the dilemma in which the Eurozone found itself. As a result of the crisis, national economic policy was increasingly a matter of international agreements. As far as the Eurogroup was concerned, the Greek debt memorandum was the roadmap. Whatever the complexion of its national government, Greece was expected to stick to it. Though form was preserved, tempers frayed, and there were rumours that Varoufakis and Dijsselbloem had almost come to blows. Schäuble would no doubt have been happy to see Greece thrown out there and then, but a personal intervention by Merkel on February 20th secured a stay of execution, allowing the new Greek government, with the approval of the creditors, to offer its own list of reform proposals to replace the memorandum. The release of the outstanding 7.2 billion euros was postponed until agreement was reached and the reforms were implemented. What followed were months of agonizing back and forth over achingly familiar ground. Would Athens be able to satisfy the creditors with its austerity proposals? Would the creditors be willing to discuss Syriza's demand for a second round of debt restructuring? It was attritional. As the negotiations dragged on, Greece's banks drained reserves, becoming ever more dependent on the ECB, while the Syriza government lost steam. For many on the left wing of Syriza, the February 20th compromise that kept Greece in the euro would come to seem a mistake. Tsipras's government had wasted the political momentum of its victory, missed its chance to carry out a popular rupture with Brussels, and henceforth negotiated from a weakening position. But Tsipras did not want to provoke a break before negotiations had even begun. Varoufakis wanted to see whether leverage would work. He knew that every time he mentioned the possibility of default on the SMP bonds, it made the ECB blanch. Was there any possibility that a compromise would be worked out? As far as the debt was concerned, Greece's insolvency was manifest. but there was no evidence that the creditors were ever willing to budge. Pursuing an Atlanticist strategy, the group around Varoufakis hoped that the swing factor in the negotiations might be the IMF. Most analysts at the fund regretted that Dominique Strauss-Kahn had enrolled the IMF in the first iteration of Extend and Pretend. 5 years on from 2010, Greece's debts were still unsustainable. Restructuring was essential. But Lagarde was loath to break with her European partners. Given her own political background, she had little sympathy for Syriza. And the IMF team on the ground was embedded with the Troika and committed to implementing its tough program. As if to reinforce the fund's commitment, the former head of its delegation to Greece, Paul Thompson, was promoted to head the IMF's entire European operation. Off the record, Thompson agreed with a majority of his IMF colleagues that the Greek debt was unsustainable. But as Athens would discover, harping on the issue of sustainability was a double-edged sword. Sustainability depended not just on the debt level, but on the future course of Greek growth. Though on issues like the fiscal multiplier, the IMF had come around to a more liberal view, when it came to long-run economic growth, the fund cleaved to the old religion. To raise its growth rate, Greece must undo labour market regulation and free restrictive business licensing. This required detailed and highly intrusive supply-side reform. Furthermore, the Greek government could always raise money through privatisation sales. To implement such measures was painful for any government. For a left coalition like Syriza, it was political suicide. If the IMF was of two minds, would its key shareholder, the United States, swing the balance? 5 years earlier, when the crisis began, Papandreou's embattled PASOK government had found comfort in Washington. In the immediate aftermath of Syriza's victory, Obama again sounded encouraging. "Too much should not be asked of a people that were already on their knees," the president opined. "You cannot keep on squeezing countries that are in the midst of depression." Meanwhile, America's celebrity economists of the center-left, headed by Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz, threw their weight behind Varoufakis's call for a rational debt program for Greece. But none of this went down well in Berlin. Nor did Athens get much sympathy from Obama's new Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew. A lawyer, hedge fund manager, and Citigroup alumnus, Lew came from the hawkish side of the Obama administration. A new Greek crisis would not be a good thing in a world economy just recovering from a deep recession, Lew pointed out. It was up to the Greek government to do its best to win its creditors' trust. As tension escalated in April, Jason Furman, the latest chairman of Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisers, weighed in to comment that a Greek crisis was not an experiment we want to run. But when he was asked to rank a disorderly Greek exit on a scale of 1 to 10, where the collapse of Lehman is a 10, Furman opined that a Greek default would likely register a 6. That is down from 8 in 2012. When the stakes had been high, Washington had not hesitated to meddle in the politics of the euro area. For a crisis that registered only 6 out of 10, Washington was not about to jeopardize its relationship with Berlin. As one American official told Varoufakis, "For us, you belong to the sphere of influence of Berlin, which we will not question." If no help could be expected from Washington, what about China, the new power in the global economy? Beijing saw the Eastern Mediterranean as a natural extension of its Eurasian One Belt, One Road logistical network. China had already taken a high-profile and controversial stake in Piraeus Port. Varoufakis eagerly explored the possibility of attracting additional Chinese capital and even Chinese intervention in the market for Greek treasury debt. Beijing seemed interested, but the bond-buying Beijing promised never materialized. When Varoufakis inquired why, the answer he received from Beijing was stark. Beijing had pulled back because Berlin had let the Chinese know that it did not welcome their intervention in the Greek crisis. China and America as partners appealed to those Greeks like Varoufakis who thought of themselves as modernizers and did not have deep roots in the Greek communist milieu. For the old guard of Syriza, Russia was the obvious option. In 2015, Merkel and Hollande were still struggling to contain the Ukraine crisis. Putin was making increasingly interventionist moves in Syria. Could Greece exploit its strategic location in the eastern Mediterranean to gain leverage? On April 8th, Tsipras travelled to Moscow to meet with Putin. But in the Kremlin, he heard the same thing that the Greeks were hearing from Washington and Beijing. Putin's message was simple. You must strike a deal with the Germans. But who in Germany was Greece to deal with? The authority in financial policy was held by Finance Minister Schäuble. But, as he made increasingly clear, he did not believe that Greece had a future in the euro area. Did Merkel share the same view? She was a more pragmatic politician than Schäuble. Surely she would not want to see the breakup of the euro. Tsipras thought he could prevail upon her through personal diplomacy. Varoufakis, on the other hand, thought that what Merkel needed to understand was the threat that Greece could pose to Draghi's stabilization efforts. Merkel exploited the gap between them. Seeking to split the Greek prime minister from his more left-wing cabinet members, she favoured him with a series of personal meetings that convinced Tsipras that she would eventually deliver a compromise. The question was when and on what terms. The longer Merkel waited, the more desperate Greece became. In April, amid talk of Greek default, the yield on the few outstanding Greek bonds still traded on open markets soared to 26.2%. Back in 2012, this might have triggered anxiety in Rome, Madrid, and Lisbon. But now there was no contagion. The ECB was unfazed. As Draghi remarked, we have enough instruments at this point in time, which although they have been designed for other purposes, would certainly be used at a crisis time if needed. We are better equipped than we were in 2012, 2011, and 2010. With the ECB's bond purchasing not only soaking up all newly issued government debt in the eurozone, but reducing the total stock of sovereign debt available for private investors by 265 billion euros, there was little reason to fear bond vigilantes. The deliberate default on the ECB's bond holdings, planned by Varoufakis, were supposed to puncture this complacency. But, as was becoming clear, Tsipras shrank from using the threat. If no compromise could be reached, and if Tsipras was unwilling to use Greece's only real weapon, was there any way out of the impasse? For the creditors, it would have been easiest if Tsipras and his eccentric crew simply disappeared from the scene. But so soon after their handsome electoral victory, that was too much to hope for. The EU was haunted by the ghosts of 2011. As the Financial Times noted, Brussels was sensitive to accusations that the EU was complicit in ending the tenure of George Papandreou, Greece's prime minister, and Silvio Berlusconi. But the Eurogroup made no secret of the fact that they wanted Tsipras to ditch Varoufakis and the left wing of his party. Historical precedents were readily to hand. Europe had a track record of curbing radical left-wing governments. After a few wild months, in the autumn of 1998, Germany's red-green government under Gerhard Schröder had jettisoned Oskar Lafontaine as finance minister. In 1983, Mitterrand's turn to a hard currency policy had presaged the ouster of the communists from his coalition government. Looking further back, the Financial Times helpfully suggested as a precedent Britain's 1931 national government. Would Tsipras be Greece's Ramsay MacDonald? After another round of bullying by the Eurogroup at the Riga summit on April 25th, with Merkel's active encouragement, Tsipras moved Varoufakis aside. He remained as finance minister, but Euclid Tsakalotos, the Minister for International Economic Relations, would be the lead debt negotiator. Another opportunity to deploy the Greek deterrent went begging. Athens was bending, but months of siege warfare were taking their toll on both sides. Merkel and Schäuble might sleep easily, but Brussels had more invested in the idea of the good Europe. In May, it seemed that the Troika might be wavering. The Commission was warming to the plucky Tsipras. The French government did not want to see Greece humiliated. the IMF was sceptical about the sustainability of the creditors' demands. It took a meeting on June 1st in Berlin to harden the resolve of the Troika and to force Syriza finally into the corner. The IMF and the Eurozone bridged their differences. The fund's worries about sustainability were soothed by requiring Athens to force through tough reforms of its labour markets and business regulations. That would allow the creditors to make optimistic assumptions about future growth and relieve them of the need to make any immediate commitment to future debt forgiveness. As far as Athens was concerned, it was the worst possible outcome. Economists in the City of London estimated that under the creditors' plan, the Greek economy would plunge by a further 12.6% by 2019, and the Greek debt ratio would soar to a staggering 200%. As Wolfgang Monschau put it in the Financial Times, Greece had nothing to lose by saying no. Acceptance of the Troika's programme would constitute a dual suicide for the Greek economy and for the political career of the Greek Prime Minister. Was it suicide or assassination? When Athens refused to yield, European efforts to delegitimize the Syriza government in the eyes of its own population were overt. Jean-Claude Juncker and Slovak Finance Minister Peter Kazimir publicly declared that their disagreements were only with Mr. Tsipras's government and not with the Greek people. Taking the hint, on June 18th, a rally of pro-Euro anti-Syriza Greeks was called on Facebook. The riot police were pulled back. The government avoided any public confrontation with the pro-EU crowd. But Syriza's confidence was rattled. The demonstrations made clear that the left were not the only ones who could mobilize extra-parliamentary forces. After the demoralizing slog of Syriza's first months in office, it was no longer obvious which side could count on more active popular support. In early June, Tsipras and Tsakalotos once more sought a compromise. Athens would meet the creditors' austerity target by a combination of increased retirement age and heavy increases in tax and social security contributions. For 48 hours, this raised hopes of a deal, but there were sticking points. While agreeing to run a huge primary budget surplus, Syriza was still insisting on political essentials, weighting the adjustment less toward welfare cuts and more toward tax increases on wealthy Greeks. This satisfied the demand for social equity, but creditors insisted that it could end up strangling the economy. Furthermore, what Syriza wanted in return was a pre-commitment to debt restructuring. On that, Germany would not budge. Without access to the last tranche of the 2012 programme, Athens was days away from defaulting. In a desperate bid to rally support, Tsipras sprang a new surprise. At 1 a.m. on the morning of June 27th, he went on television to announce that he was calling a referendum. It would be up to the Greek people to decide either to accept or to reject the creditors' memorandum. Tsipras, for his part, declared that he would campaign against acceptance, calling on the Greek population to reject the blackmail ultimatum. The Eurogroup was horrified. As Merkel made clear, with the Athens government campaigning against agreement, there could be no further compromise. The following day, Sunday, June 28th, the ECB pulled the trigger. It froze its emergency liquidity support for Greece's banks at its current level. The next day, this would unleash a disastrous bank run. The ECB could have gone further. It could have terminated emergency liquidity assistance altogether and demanded repayment. At the crisis meeting of the ECB's board, there were certainly votes to be had for such a drastic course of action, but the ECB's overwhelming power put Draghi in a delicate position. As a member of the Troika and chief provider of financial life support to the Greek banking system, the ECB was judge, jury, and executioner. Draghi did not want to appear as though he were further escalating the tension or deliberately worsening Greece's financial plight. Capping Greek access to liquidity assistance was drastic enough. To avoid an immediate collapse, the Greek banks were preemptively closed, cash withdrawals were limited to 60 euros per day, and capital controls limited capital flight. Middle-class depositors formed impatient queues to withdraw their cash. Greece's privately owned media were in an uproar. The irresponsible radicals of Syriza, they told their audience, had taken the country over the edge. With the creditors refusing either to negotiate or to make concessions until the results of the referendum were known, on June 30th, Athens announced that it was delaying payment on money owed to the IMF. This was no mere administrative matter. The IMF is acknowledged as the super senior creditor in international lending. Being in arrears to the IMF put Greece on a short list that included Sudan, Somalia, Zimbabwe, Afghanistan, and Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. And the size of its debts was unprecedented. Greece owed repayment on $26 billion to the IMF over the next 10 years. But at this crucial moment, the IMF did not respond as one might have expected. In the summer of 2015, the dissatisfaction inside the fund over the European approach to the Greek debt crisis finally broke into the open. Between a first blog post by its chief economist, Olivier Blanchard, in mid-June, and the formal issuance of a paper on Greek debt sustainability in mid-July, the world's leading financial authority declared the policy of extend and pretend, practiced since 2010, both economically and politically unsustainable. Greece would have to make further tough decisions, no doubt, but the Troika and the Eurogroup needed to stop pretending that that would be enough. Debt restructuring had to be on the table. With the backing of the US board members overriding resistance from the European representatives, on July 2nd, the IMF published a preliminary report outlining the full absurdity of the programs so far. Instead of the 50 billion euros in privatization receipts scheduled in 2012, Greece had received 3.2 billion. The current program and all the variants haggled over since Syriza took office were unrealistic. No one who was serious would proceed on the basis that primary surpluses of 4%, massive structural changes and 2% GDP growth per annum were a realistic scenario. After what their country had been through since 2010, no political party in Greece could be expected to own such a drastic policy mix. Without ownership, one could not expect fulfillment. The IMF now called for at least 50 billion euros in debt relief, a doubling of repayment times, and 36 billion euros in short-term financing to allow Greece to survive until 2018. It was a nasty surprise to the Europeans that the Americans would have let this happen. As late as early June, at the convivial G7 meeting in Bavaria, Obama had acted the part of a loyal ally. But it was a measure of the stability that Europe had now attained that the clash should have come out into the open. The only consideration that had justified the IMF's involvement in the Greek bailout in May 2010 was the risk of systemic contagion. Thanks to Mario Draghi's bond buying, there was no longer any risk of that. The IMF could afford to voice principled opposition without fear of practical consequences. It would make no new commitments to the Eurozone's exercise in self-delusion. But it did not do the one thing that would have placed Berlin under serious pressure. It did not withdraw from the Troika. For the Greek population, the choices were starker. Did they dare to challenge the creditors? Would a no vote mean the end of Greek membership in the Euro or even the EU? Despite overt and massive intimidation, on July 5th, a remarkable 61.31% voted against accepting the Troika proposal. Given that the plan had by that point been repudiated as unsustainable by the IMF, the vote was not so much a wild act of political desperation as a brave and much-needed assertion of common sense. But the response from the creditors' side was unyielding. Athens had until July 12th to come up with an even more austere and even less sustainable proposal or face expulsion from the Eurozone. On July 9th, with help from the French Treasury, the Syriza government cobbled together a new scheme, taking up a compromise on welfare cuts and tax increases proposed by the Commission and coupling it to an appeal for modest debt write-offs and new credits of 53 billion euros. For the left wing of Syriza, it was shameful surrender. Varoufakis, who resigned following the referendum, joined the internal party opposition. Meanwhile, Tsipras set off to Strasbourg in the hope of rallying support across Europe. On July 10th, he made an appearance in the European Parliament, where he was greeted by a storm of approving whistles, not only from the left, but also from the far right. Boos and catcalls came from the centre. European politics were dividing between upholders of the status quo and a motley crew denouncing the Eurozone as a German prison. On Saturday, July 11th, with the principals scheduled to meet the following day, the finance ministers of Europe gathered in Brussels for a pre-meeting. It soon became clear that, far from softening, Berlin's position had hardened. If Greece wanted to stay in the Eurozone, Schäuble insisted that it must demonstrate its credibility by agreeing to a 50 billion euro collateral fund made up of Greek national assets placed under direct creditor control. With that in place, there could be further loans and another effort to make a go of extend and pretend. Alternatively, if Greece preferred the path of sovereignty, Schäuble offered a 5-year time-out from the Eurozone, which might be accompanied by debt restructuring and humanitarian relief. There was talk of emergency supplies of medicines to Greek hospitals. What was not on the table was a repeat of 2012, deep debt restructuring with Greece remaining in the Eurozone. Haircutting banks was one thing, haircutting the German taxpayer quite another. Greece would have to exit. But what if it did? What if Greece took the time-out option? It would mean that Eurozone membership was reduced to a conditional status. How long would it be before Schäuble was offering a time-out to Italy or Spain? For the French it was unacceptable. The Germans posed as the paymasters of Europe, but France too would bear a heavy burden in the event of any Greek rupture. The French had worked closely with Athens to draft its latest compromise proposal. Schäuble had simply swept it aside. To clear the air, Michel Sapin, the French finance minister, proposed that they just get it all out and tell one another the truth to blow off steam. The group therapy didn't go well. The ensuing conversation was described by one participant as extremely hard, violent even. Significantly, the battle went beyond national interest. In the words of France's youthful economy minister, Emmanuel Macron, Greece was provoking a veritable European civil war, a war of religion, with the Nordics, the East Europeans, Germany and the Netherlands in one camp, and France, Italy, Spain and the rest in the other. A painful climax was reached when Schäuble and Draghi locked horns, and the German finance minister ended up fuming that he was not an idiot. At that point, Dijsselbloem thought it best to call a halt to proceedings. The deal would have to be done by the heads of government the following day. When the climactic summit began on the afternoon of Sunday, July 12, 2015, despite the presence of the entire Union, the negotiations involved only 4 actors. Merkel, Tsipras, who was advised by his new finance minister, Donald Tusk as president of the European Council, and Hollande, effectively representing the wider interests of the other member states. The negotiations were laborious and painful. Merkel abandoned Schäuble's alarming time-out proposal, but clung to the guarantee fund. Tsipras conceded the fund, but could not accept that it should be run out of Brussels or Luxembourg. It would control Greek assets. It must be headquartered in Athens. As Hollande insisted, it was a question of sovereignty. Merkel conceded. The fund would be sited in Greece and could be used, if necessary, to recapitalize Greece's banks and for other domestic investment purposes. But even with that compromise agreed, by early in the morning of Monday, July 13th, there was still no deal. At 7 a.m., after a full night of talks, Merkel and Tsipras were 2.5 billion euros apart. Both, it seemed, wanted to walk away in exhausted frustration. At this fateful moment, Tusk intervened. The two parties could abandon the talks, but if they did, he would not hesitate to tell the world that they had allowed Europe to fail over what was, in the final analysis, a trivial amount of money. It wasn't the prospect of economic disaster that brought Merkel to her senses, but the likely political fallout from letting Greece go. When it came to the moment of decision, she did not feel bound by financial logic. She did not want to be the chancellor who broke Europe. That was more important than finally resolving the question of Greek debt. She split the difference. Germany would agree to yet another bailout. Greece would receive new loans from Europe, totaling 86 billion euros. In exchange, Athens accepted severe intrusions on its sovereignty. It was required to whip through yet more cuts within 48 hours. Parliamentary sovereignty was reduced to a rubber stamp. There was no rupture. Greece was still in the eurozone. Europe had regained its capacity for a rather brutal form of collective action. The ECB had demonstrated the pacifying power of central bank intervention. Greece was held on the path of reform demanded by the Troika. But as the IMF's démarche had made clear, this was a matter of politics as much as financial crisis management. The European creditors had doggedly refused to discuss the only issue that mattered, debt restructuring. What was at stake was not macroeconomic performance, but the imposition of discipline on a wayward Eurozone member. Shielded from financial contagion, a conservative financial settlement had been demonstratively imposed on a left-wing government with a strong democratic mandate. The perverse effect of the ECB's liberating move to QE was that it allowed extend and pretend and its concomitant relentless austerity to continue. Launched by Syriza sympathizers in Barcelona on the night of July 12th to 13th, hashtag ThisIsACoup went viral on Twitter, being taken up by 377,000 users worldwide in a matter of hours and generating a billion impressions in a matter of days. Closer to home, in Athens, members of the left platform led by Panagiotis Lafazanis, the former energy and environment minister, met at the Oscar Hotel on the night of July 14th to discuss how they might go through with the Grexit that Schäuble had offered but Merkel, Tusk, Hollande and Tsipras had done everything to avoid. It had been a mistake not to make the break with Brussels already in February. Now, before the prison door closed once more, they should effect a rupture, if necessary by radical means. Their target was the National Mint, where they believed 22 billion euros were held in reserves, enough to cover pensions and other essential government bills until they had rolled out a new national currency. If the central bank governor, Yanis Stornaris, resisted, as they expected he would, they would have him arrested. The meeting was far from clandestine. There were journalists swarming outside the hotel. It is hard to know how seriously to take such talk, but as one participant recalled, obviously it was a moment of high tension. You were aware of a real revolutionary spirit in the room. It didn't come to that. Tsipras and the mainstream of Syriza whipped the necessary measures through Parliament. The left wing split from Syriza, only to be humiliated in the September general election, which vindicated Tsipras's leadership, returning him with a virtually unchanged majority and the new loan deal in place. A majority of Greeks, it turned out, wanted Eurozone membership, even at the price of continued Troika oversight. Across Europe, what shocked centrists was the violence of the July clashes. Donald Tusk, who had seen the final round of negotiations up close, agreed with the Greek radicals. There was a real mood of revolutionary impatience in the air. As far as Tusk, a Cold War liberal and veteran of Solidarność, was concerned, it was all very alarming. "Too much Rousseau, not enough Montesquieu," he told a bemused audience of financial journalists. Jürgen Habermas, the closest equivalent to those Enlightenment thinkers 21st-century Europe has to offer, was aghast. Merkel had carried out an act of punishment against Greece's left-wing government, he told The Guardian. "I fear that the German government, including its social democratic faction, have gambled away in one night all the political capital that a better Germany had accumulated in half a century. Germany had unashamedly revealed itself as Europe's chief disciplinarian, and for the first time openly made a claim for German hegemony in Europe." There was no doubt, of course, that Merkel and Schäuble had played a strong hand. But what exactly did they have to show for it? What upset German right-wingers was not the bruising nature of the encounters with Greece, but how little Germany had gained. Who, after all, was the victor in the decisive encounters of July 12th to 13th, 2015? Certainly not Schäuble, who had been cut loose by his own chancellor. What had prevailed was the determination to preserve Europe at the price of another unsustainable bailout deal. For the German right, Merkel's sellout in the Greek crisis was a fitting prelude to her disastrous betrayal of the German nation in the Syrian refugee crisis that autumn. The beneficiary was the AfD, the right-wing, pro-market party that had first come into existence in April 2013 to protest against Berlin's endless concessions in the Eurozone crisis. As Schäuble would snark, the AfD's rise was 50% down to Draghi. The other half, presumably, was down to his boss and her liberal posturing over the Syrians. Schäuble was no xenophobe. The historic stakes were high. What Merkel was jeopardizing with her dithering concessions was the historic mission of the CDU, to tame German nationalism and to bind it to Europe. The German right wing saw some things clearly. They understood that, as powerful as it was, Germany's dominance was incomplete at best. What had stabilized the Eurozone in 2012 was a half-hearted lurch toward deeper integration covered by the market's perception that Draghi was finally Americanizing the ECB. In 2015, once more, it was not simply German conservatism that triumphed. The necessary complement to the containment of Syriza was QE. As it had been in the United States, it was a perversely complementary package. Austerity without QE would have been paralyzing in economic terms. QE without austerity would have been impossible politically for conservatives to bear. How tightly the two were coupled would become clear in the second half of 2015 as the tensions left by the Eurozone crisis continued to rack European politics. The anti-Syriza front in the Eurogroup had reason to worry. First in Portugal in October 2015, and then in Spain in December 2015, elections delivered serious blows to the conservative and centrist parties that had towed the line of austerity since 2010. In the Spanish general election of December 2015, the two-party system based on the conservatives and the socialists that had shaped the transition to democracy since General Franco's death in 1975 imploded. With the conservatives crashing to 28% and the socialists to 22%, they commanded the loyalty of only half the electorate. The majority of the rest was shared between two entirely new parties, Podemos and the Citizens Party. Podemos scored 20.7%, which was disappointing only when compared with the 30% plus it had commanded in the polls shortly after its formation in 2014. It lost support in 2015, in part because of the beating being dealt out to Syriza, but also because of the rise of the even newer Citizens Party, which described itself as a progressive party espousing a program of social, cultural, and economic liberalism. Both Podemos and the Citizens Party promised a new set of clean hands to overcome corruption. Both did remarkably well. But the outcome of the election was inconclusive. No side had a clear majority to govern. The divide between the socialists and Podemos was too deep to enable a left-wing government. In 2016, after a second round of voting, the dogged conservative Prime Minister Rajoy clung on. With its economy limping back from the dead, Spain, like Ireland, would be celebrated as the poster child for austerity adjustment policies. In Portugal, the economic recovery was slower. Unlike Spain, it had borne the brunt of a full-blown Troika program. In 2015, its youth unemployment rate was just shy of 60%, and long-term unemployment hovered around 40%. The PAF centre-right coalition, headed by Pedro Passos Coelho, who had taken office in June 2011, had fought the long fight for Eurozone stabilisation. When the election campaign began, it had seemed as though PAF would be roundly defeated, but the turmoil in Greece and the protection offered by the ECB's QE contributed to swinging the result. On October 4th, 2015, Coelho and the PAF saw their vote plunge relative to their 2011 result by 12%, but at 38.6% they still came in far ahead of the socialists at 32.3%. With relief, President Cavaco Silva, a conservative financial economist, turned to Coelho to make the first attempt to form a new government. But though PAF had won a plurality, it was a long way short of a viable majority. The socialists, though their electoral performance had been disappointing, had other options. If they were willing to form an alliance with a radical left bloc, Portugal's equivalent of Syriza, and the ex-communist Unitary Democratic Coalition, they had a majority. Pulling off this alignment would require a break with the taboos of the Cold War and the conventions of Portuguese democracy since the end of dictatorship in the 1970s. As was true in Germany for the SPD and Die Linke, the Portuguese socialists had hitherto refused to deal with the ex-communists. But after years of austerity, PS leader António Costa took the plunge and entered talks to form a three-party left-wing government. How would President Silva respond? It was for him a profound dilemma. As he stated with remarkable frankness, in 40 years of democracy, the Portuguese governments had never depended on the radical left parties, which questioned the Lisbon Treaty, the EU's budgetary treaty, the banking union, the Stability and Growth Pact, the euro, and NATO membership. As the president made clear, as far as he was concerned, the right to govern in Portugal depended on a commitment to those institutions and the values they embodied. And in 2015, there was a further correlate. Portugal must qualify for inclusion in the ECB's quantitative easing program. It was Draghi's bond buying that had given Portugal shelter from the Greek storm. Eligibility for inclusion in the ECB program, in turn, depended, by fiat of the ECB, on the rating of the international credit agencies. The best-known ratings agencies, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's, had all downgraded Portugal to junk in 2011. The only exception was DBRS, the least well-known of the international ratings agencies. It was on DBRS's bond rating that Portugal's membership in the respectable club of Europe depended. If it were to drop out of the ECB program, the financial consequences would be catastrophic. And as far as President Silva was concerned, that had clear implications. This, Silva opined, is the worst moment for a radical change to the foundations of our democracy. After we carried out an onerous program of financial assistance entailing heavy sacrifices, it is my duty, within my constitutional powers, to do everything possible to prevent false signals being sent to financial institutions, investors, and markets. To allow the left-wing majority to take power would be a false signal. Unsurprisingly, after the events in Greece, Angela Merkel was not shy about letting it be known that she agreed. The prospect of a left-wing anti-austerity coalition in Lisbon was very negative. But what option did President Silva have? He couldn't very well call new elections with an alternative government ready and waiting. On November 24th, Silva faced the inevitable and named Costa as Portuguese Prime Minister. But he did not simply allow the majority principle to prevail either. Instead, in a constitutionally dubious arrangement, Silva made Costa's appointment conditional on promises. The government must respect Portugal's commitments to the European Union's Stability Pact, whereby all Eurozone members were required to reduce budget deficits to below 3% of GDP. It must remain committed to NATO. It must continue with the restructuring of Portugal's ailing banking system as previously planned. It must limit the role of trade unions in deciding government policy and respect the existing balance between employers and labour. Schäuble had announced that elections should not change economic policy. Portugal's president clearly agreed. Watched over by the president, the creditor governments of the EU, the ECB, the bond rating agencies, and the bond markets, the left coalition took office. What it could do with political power, whether Portuguese democracy within the frame of the Eurozone was more than a matter of extend and pretend, would depend on its ability to bend the constraints imposed upon it. At least, unlike Greece, the arithmetic of Portugal's debts did not condemn it from the start. Against left-wing governments in weak and dependent members of the Eurozone, the tactics of financial pressure worked. The Eurogroup's project of political and economic discipline prevailed. For all their bravado and the genuine excitement they awakened both at home and abroad, the governments of Tsipras and Costa did not promise revolution. They promised national autonomy and self-respect, and above all, social improvement. This made them vulnerable to the threat of immediate economic suffocation. After all, what good with a small increment to your pension or shorter waiting lists for social housing if a cap on ECB liquidity assistance left you unable to get cash out of the bank? But the challenge to the status quo in the EU did not come only from the left. Overshadowed by the struggles with Greece, the nationalist wave that had made itself felt in the European parliamentary election of May 2014 was gathering force. In 2014, it was the FN, UKIP, and the Danish People's Party that made the headlines. The following year, the British Conservative Party unexpectedly won an outright majority in the May 2015 general election. The British Conservatives were a broad church. David Cameron had led the party out of the wilderness of opposition along the path of cultural modernisation. But the right wing of the party belonged squarely in the nationalist camp, preoccupied with sovereignty, immigration, and flag-waving traditionalism. Further to the right lurked the mavericks of the anti-EU UKIP, excluded from Westminster, but the winners of the European elections in 2014. A few weeks after the British Conservatives' victory, the Law and Justice Party won the Polish presidency on a ticket of overt nationalism and cultural conservatism. They, too, were nationalists, hostile to the intrusions of Brussels and the threat of German domination. Over the summer and autumn of 2015, the drama of the Syrian refugee crisis and Angela Merkel's well-intentioned but cack-handed response fed the nationalist flames. Germany was not just imperious, it was opening the doors of an alien invasion. It was a double gift for nationalist demagogues. By the autumn of 2015, Law and Justice had captured the Polish parliament and government, as well as the presidency. Together, Poland and the UK accounted for 100 million citizens of the EU, 20% of the total, with governments pandering to the most sceptical Europhobic elements. It was unsettling to Brussels, but it had wider ramifications too. Historically, the UK was America's preeminent ally in Europe, both in NATO and as the anchor of the transatlantic euro-dollar system. Since the early 2000s, Poland had been in the van of Donald Rumsfeld's New Europe. It was the East European state most closely aligned with America's geopolitical project. Earlier in the year, Syriza had tried in vain to gain leverage in Europe by interesting global actors in its predicament. The United States, China, and Russia had all declined. They would not meddle in Germany's sphere of interest. Poland and the UK posed challenges to the EU status quo that were far harder to contain.
Chapter 23. The Fear Projects. The year 2016 began with the nationalist government in Warsaw picking fights with Brussels over the freedom of the press, the independence of the judiciary, and abortion rights. In their challenge to the EU, they could count on applause from Viktor Orbán's self-proclaimed illiberal democracy in Hungary. Meanwhile, the British government was demanding negotiations over opt-outs from the European future. The British Prime Minister let Brussels know that he would be happy to take a pro-European position. But from the outset, Cameron's approach was disconcertingly transactional. If he did not get the concessions he demanded, his threat was that he would lead the campaign against EU membership in a referendum scheduled for the summer of 2016. Nationalism and xenophobia were the common denominators of the challenges from the right. But, unlike the leadership of Law and Justice, Cameron was in an awkward position. He was struggling to square a groundswell of popular sentiment fanned by the propagandists of his own party with a broader agenda of business-driven globalism. Since the 1970s, EU membership had shaped the competitive modernisation of the UK economy. The Tories, as much as any party, had participated in that drive. The City of London, in its 21st century form, had emerged as one of the most important strands of the UK-EU relationship. Its offshore relationship to the Eurozone had defined both Britain's and Europe's places in the networks of financial globalisation and their relationship to the United States. Now, in an extraordinarily high-risk bid to channel and manage the politics of popular nationalism, the Tory government was putting London's position as a crucial node in the network of global economy in play. Less than 10 years earlier, the City of London had been riding high. It was the prize jewel in New Labour's economic crown. It was Britain's ticket to global significance. It was the standard the deregulators of Wall Street aspired to, the location of choice for fast-moving, high-end global finance. All the more shattering was the shock of 2008. The city became a site of crisis and failure. Tens of thousands lost their jobs. The two most resilient UK banks, Barclays and HSBC, sidestepped Brown's ballyhooed programme of recapitalisation. This left the government to nationalise not just Northern Rock, but Lloyds HBOS and RBS as well. In the wake of the crisis, rebalancing was an agenda shared by both Labour and the coalition government that replaced it. British banking legislation went well beyond Dodd-Frank. The once widely touted FSA was abolished. Banking supervision was reincorporated into the Bank of England. The new conception of macroprudentialism did not allow for a neat distinction between regulation and economic policy functions. The Banking Reform Act of 2013 would divide up bank functions and ring-fence retail activity. Financial services were no longer part of Britain's narrative of national success. But unlike in the case of Wall Street, tightening the regulation of British banks is not the same as curbing the City of London. The city is not, first and foremost, a national financial centre. Its main business is global. The conference in London on July 26, 2012, at which Draghi made his famous speech, was an event for global investors designed to showcase the city. Ahead of the Olympic Games, Bank of England Governor Mervyn King had sport on his mind. The City of London, he remarked, was like the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club, the hosts of Wimbledon. The setting is quintessentially English, but it is a global tournament. Though King didn't elaborate, the further implication of his remarks was that Britain's banks stood to the city as Britain's eternally struggling national tennis program stood to Wimbledon. They were a national preoccupation. They might produce the occasional champion, but neither they nor the rest of the British economy were the main attraction. The modern City of London had been built on the euro-dollar system. Thanks to the Fed, that had survived the crisis. But the American regulators understood London's role as the platform for some of the most extreme risks that the American banks had built up. As it was put to a congressional committee in 2012 by a senior US regulator, the United States had allowed its risks to migrate to London only for them to come right back here crashing to our shores. Within the capacious framework of Dodd-Frank, US regulators were now sharply tightening the regulations of foreign banks in the United States and of US bank operations overseas. The European banks that had epitomized the connection between the City of London and Wall Street, the likes of Barclays and Deutsche, UBS and Credit Suisse,